just put each man to that, not to be discussed. Our request that we stand up and observe a moment of silence. Whilst we are waiting for the technicians, I guess we can proceed with the business of the day. And I am going to ask Advocate Abrahams to address us, and then after that he will tell us who else is going to follow over to.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you for giving the floor to me. Good morning, Honourable Members of the Committee, my colleagues from the National Prosecuting Authority, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen. Honourable Chairperson, allow me to briefly introduce the members of my team that are present with me today. On my immediate left is Dr. Silas Ramahiti, SC, a Deputy National Director of Public Prosecution, who heads administration and the Office for Witness Protection. To his left is Advocate Toko Majokweni, who's an acting Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions. She heads the National Prosecuting Services, which is a core function of the National Prosecuting Authority. To her immediate left is Ms. Malone Beloy, who's from Strategy and Risk. She heads that subunit, the National Prosecuting Authority. To her left is Ms. Monica Fazell, who heads finance in the FDA. And then we have Ms. Bulawa Mapeke, who heads communication and who is somewhat of a versatile leader in the FDA.
They are very scarce. It means they're working hard where they are. The only person that I see on the ground is Advocate Majokweni. I think she has her eyes on the situation. Okay. Now you are most welcome, Advocate.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. We have the honour today of presenting the National Prosecuting Authority's annual performance plan for the period 2017 to 2018, the budget allocation for the MTM period, and the performance for Q2 and Q3. For the period 2016 to 2017. Prior to commencing with the presentation, I deem it necessary to pass a few introductory remarks. The MTA is committed to the realization of the goals set by government through the National Development Plan. The MTA serves as sub-program 4 of the Department of Justice and is further committed to giving effect to the long-term vision of the JCPS delivery agreement as the NPA's main priority by ensuring that all people in South Africa are safe and feel safe. In line with government's vision of a better life for all, the NPA supports the priorities set out in a medium-term strategic framework. To this end, the NPA strategic plan is still aligned with the MTSF. Both the NPA strategic plan for 2017 to 2020 and the APP for 2017 to 2018 are aligned to the strategic objectives and the budget structure. The NPA is critically positioned to act in the interest of all people, more particularly in the interest of victims of crime, and as far as possible to remove the perpetrators of crime from society. It is no secret that I advocate a victim-centric service in delivering justice to our people. Yesterday, Honourable Matisse, before this very committee, raised a concern around the effect of crime on victims of crime and the issue of economic exclusion. Honourable Chairperson, Section 234 of our Constitution provides for the adoption of a Charter of Rights. In this regard, it reads, open quote, "In order to deepen the culture of democracy established by the Constitution, Parliament may adopt charters of rights consistent with the provisions of the Constitution," close quote. The Service Charter for the Victims of Crime in South Africa commonly known as the Victims Charter, was approved by Cabinet as far back as 1 December 2004. The Victims Charter is also compliant with the United Nations Declaration of Basic Principles of Justice for Victims of Crime and the Abuse of or Power. The Victims Charter is an extremely essential instrument embodying the rights and obligations relating to services applicable to victims and survivors of crime in South Africa. Over the years, there has been much focus on a victim-centered service in delivering justice to society. This is in line with the National Crime Prevention Strategy and, more importantly, the National Development Plan, that all people in South Africa are safe and ultimately feel safe. Last year, the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, Honourable Minister Michael Masuta, commenced an evaluation process regarding the implementation of the Victims' Charter and the minimum standards. This evaluation must be viewed in the context of ongoing monitoring and evaluation and the need to develop evidence-based practice and good practice models in our justice system. Minister Masuta commissioned a ministerial task team under the leadership of the National Director of Public Prosecutions to inter alia identify gaps and challenges in the implementation of the Charter and whether the principles and values espoused therein are being applied effectively. The work, in collaboration with other stakeholders, is at an advanced stage. The task team will further be required to establish whether South Africa is on a par with national and international norms and standards, and whether it is possible for assistance to be afforded to victims of crime considering different models in comparable jurisdictions. Honourable Chairperson, yesterday, before this very committee, the Acting Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, Honourable Minister Faith Mutambi, mentioned that the Department of Justice and the NPA are at the forefront of developing a comprehensive victim-centric approach to deal with sexual and gender-based violence. The Sexual Offences and Community Affairs Unit within the NPA was established as far back as October 1999 with the main objective of eradicating all forms of gender-based violence against women and children. It is a well-known fact that at the time, sexual offences and in particular rape in this country had reached alarming proportions in several research studies conducted by independent researchers and sought to espouse the relevant case law. In 2000, SOCA commissioned a study with a monitor group to determine the conviction rate in rape cases, finalising court. At the time, that exercise yielded a 48% conviction rate. This prompted SOCA to design the Tutazela Care Centre model, which serves as one-stop facilities that have been introduced as a critical part of South Africa's anti-rape strategy to holistically provide rape care management that is effective and efficient to victims of sexual and gender-based violence. This model makes use of an integrated strategy for prevention, response and support, thereby providing for a broader focus to rape care management than the reactionary response aspects of the criminal justice system. Today, the conviction rate of sexual offences sits at a very dignified and impressive 72%. Although there are presently only 55 TC centres, the NPA, with the aid of CARA funds, is optimistic to roll out a further 5 TC centres and upgrade those in need of same within the next 3 years. The TC centre model espouses the principles envisaged in the Victims' Charter, which is government's initiative that seeks to cultivate a human rights culture by ensuring that victims' needs, either material or emotional, are met, thereby recognizing the significance of restorative justice in society. It further envisages to eliminate secondary victimization in the criminal justice process and ensuring that the victims of crime remain central to the criminal justice process and system. The TC Centre model promotes the cooperation of all relevant stakeholders and has become internationally recognized as SOCA through the Africa Prosecutors Association has assisted many countries in Africa to emulate the very same model with great success. Honourable Chairperson, we are mindful of the various crime typologies affecting specific communities when working in close collaboration with stakeholders and the very communities to alleviate the plight of the most vulnerable. The President of the Republic, Honorable President Zuma, has over the last few months emphasized the need for greater collaboration and cohesion between law enforcement authorities and communities in the fight against crime, in particular the need to inter alia combat the use of drugs and drug trafficking, human trafficking, gangsterism, money laundering, illicit financial flows, corruption, the illegal possession of firearms, crimes against women and children, rape and murder. Honorable Chairperson, we remain committed to create more impactful cohesion and synergy with our stakeholders in this regard in improving the lives of all. The National Prosecuting Authority is represented at the Forum of Heads of Entities convened by the Director General, Justice and Constitutional Development to ensure effective delivery in the criminal justice system, as commented on by Minister Faith Mutambi during an address before the very committee yesterday. The NPA remains reliant on support and synergy from its stakeholders in the criminal justice system, a multidisciplinary collaborative effort with critical stakeholders, including the community, is critical in winning the war on crime and reinstilling public confidence in the criminal justice system. The NPA continues to be presented quarterly at provincial efficiency enhancement committee meetings chaired by respective judge presidents, and annually at the national efficiency enhancement committee meeting chaired by the chief justice to inter alia improve on giving effect the norms and standards as set by the Chief Justice and to improve on challenges around case flow management. We are nearing the conclusion of submission to the Minister of Justice a proposal on an accountability structure as envisioned in Section 22, Subsection 5 of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. Last year, we hosted an organized crime workshop at which all stakeholders were invited to improve synergy in the fight against organized crime. We have gradually strengthened the already stretched resources capacity in the region to fight organized crime. Asset Forfeiture Unit is reprioritizing its usual concentration on high-value cases by working closer with key stakeholders and the community to remove the proceeds of crime. Chairperson, we continue our endeavors with equal vigor to fight the scourge of corruption in both the private sector and in government. To eradicate illicit money flows, an informal working group consisting of various law enforcement agencies was assembled under the guidance of the National Director to look into this phenomenon in August last year. The working group's approach was to consider previous and current investigations and to engage with domestic and foreign law enforcement agencies and the private sector to determine the extent, veracity and modus operandi of illicit flows. This work is still ongoing. The NPA recently appeared before the Portfolio Committee on Finance, where we took that committee into confidence on our work and collaborative efforts in combating illicit flows. Honourable Chairperson, budget constraints, however, remain a major challenge. This will be highlighted in greater detail during our presentation on the budget allocation for the MTF. Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee, I'd like to thank this committee for its guidance and support in the execution of its oversight responsibilities to enable us to provide a more efficient criminal justice system to improve the lives of all people in making South Africa a safer place for all. Honourable Chairperson, Dr. Silas Ramaiti will now present the NPA's annual performance plan for the period 2017 to 2018, after which Ms. Hanika van Sail will present our budget for the MTF and Ms. Baloni our performance for Q2 and Q3 for the period 2016-2017.
Before we take those inputs, let me just repeat what I said in the committee yesterday, that your plans are very impressive. It's quite clear that you know what you want to do, but the question remains that there appears to be a great communication breakdown training our Ministry of Justice and its entities and the people because of the language question. We are training so many lawyers in the country. They are all English speaking, but the majority of the people speak the indigenous languages. And it is our view that going forward, no one should be able to get a law degree unless they have passed one or the other of the indigenous languages. And also that a look should be made on changing the curriculum in such a way that we include one or the other of the social sciences, because law is not just a mastery of rules. It has to do with people. Now, if we don't understand society and how it functions, how do we then extend the rights to people? The other question is, if you look at the human rights instruments, there's a tendency in this country to want to comply with the UN and other international instruments, but the indigenous African human rights instruments are not taken seriously. For instance, you'll hear about UN Convention on the Rights of Children, but you'll never hear anything about the Charter on the Rights of the African Child. So we also have a situation where there's a lot of advocacy for restorative justice. But this restorative justice is rooted in African cultures and traditions. But our universities don't teach African law. Now, when matters have got to go on appeal from the traditional courts, they go to the magistrate courts, and those magistrates know nothing about African law. How can we then claim to be dispensing justice? So we are happy to see that there is a forum of entities led by the DG, and we want to recommend this matter be taken to that forum, and then we will want to get a report of that when we meet again, because justice must be accessible, and it can be accessible if the language used is not accessible. But otherwise, thank you very much for a good presentation. Honorable members, I guess we will agree that we take the next input. Are we happy with that? Advocate Mashamaita.
Thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members of the committee. We have prepared a formal presentation in the form of PowerPoint. Unfortunately, I'm constrained because it seems as if we are unable to project it, and I'm not so sure if the honorable members have hard copies of the presentation. If that is so, then for the benefit of the honorable members, let me just give a broad outline of the manner in which I am going to do the presentation. I will just give a broad overview of the annual performance plan as well as the amendments, and that will be in the pack that I have. That should be slide 6 to slide 7. That would then just be the broad overview. If I may proceed, Chairperson. Okay, the broad overview is that in respect of the objectives of the MPA, they are linked to the various sub-programs in terms of the core business of the sub-programs. There have been no changes to the strategic objectives. We remain with three strategic objectives, which is increase successful prosecution, ensure profit is removed from crime, then ensure vulnerable and intimidated witnesses and related persons are successfully protected. And then slide 7, we then deal with the amendments that have been effected to the APP without having changed the strategic objectives. The strategic objective ensure that threatened witnesses and related persons are successfully protected has been revised to ensuring that vulnerable and intimidated witnesses and related persons are successfully protected. The reason for that was that there was an audit query which actually necessitated that we relook at this. But it also encapsulates more accurately the function of the Office for Witness Protection. And then the following indicators were removed from the APP, that is the number of cases finalized with a verdict, as well as the number of cases finalized through ADRM, which were two separate indicators. They have now been consolidated into one indicator, which is all criminal court matters finalized, which then includes alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And then the target for the number of operational Tuzela care centers has been reduced from 60 to 55 for the MTES period, that is for the 3 years going forward, as a result of budgetary constraints. And then if we move to slide number 8, the following targets were not increased, and you will see as we then go to the actual content of the APP, they were not increased mainly due to optimal performance. In other words, what we are saying is they reflect our optimal performance in view of the current capacity that we have, because we do not expect to have any additional capacity in the next 3 years going forward, and therefore it becomes pointless to actually increase the targets or to stretch the targets, so to speak, because we are highly unlikely to reach any stretch targets. Now, these are the conviction rates that is in the High Court, Regional Court, in respect of organized crime, fuel crimes, and complex commercial crime. And then the following AFU, that is asset forfeiture indicator, has been revised in order to address an audit query in respect of whether it actually reflects the actual achievement of the AFU. So the number of completed cases, that is the actual numbers, has now been changed to reflect a percentage of measurement. And the indicator now reads as follows: percentage of completed forfeiture cases, that is percentage of all forfeiture cases taken on, whether, for example, if it's 80%, then obviously that's a higher achievement. If it's 90%, then that's an even higher achievement. If it's 100%, then that means that we've completed all the cases that we've taken on in the financial year. And then the number of freezing orders has been changed once again to percentages as opposed to numbers. And then there's also an expansion of success rates to be more specific in respect of what success rates. So it's now more specific and refers to litigation success rates as opposed to just general success rate. And this was done to enhance the meaning of success rate in measuring the ASU overall performance. If Chairperson, with your permission, I may then proceed to the actual content of the annual performance plan, which is contained in slide 10 to slide 18 of the pack that we have provided. The first strategic objective is increased successful prosecution, and that is delivered through the National Prosecution Service. As we have mentioned previously, the National Prosecution Service consists of the mainstream prosecution in the various DPP's offices, but it now includes the specialized units such as the Specialized Commercial Crimes Unit, the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, as well as sexual offences. There is one objective under that strategic objective, and that is conviction. That is now under the mainstream prosecution. That is conviction rate in the courts, the high courts, the regional courts, as well as the district courts. We have provided an indication of the audited performance for the financial years 2013 to 2015 and 16. You will note that the estimated performance for 2016-2017 is 87%. I'm not so sure where we are, but we are actually likely to go a little bit above that. But then we have used that as a measure to set our medium-term targets. So in other words, what we are saying is, for the high courts, our medium-term targets for 2017-18, 2019-20 is 87%. We have now also provided the estimated numbers there. But you will see that it is not significantly different from our achievement in the 2013-2014. 2013-14 in the high courts were 88%. But what we are saying is, in view of the limited constraints and our optimal performance, we think that 87% is fair. But that does not mean that we're not going to strive to actually exceed that target. We were just cautious to set stretch targets. For example, if we had set a target of, let's say, 90%, we were just setting ourselves for failure, or setting our people for failure, so to speak. And then the regional courts for the 3 years is 74%, and for the district courts for the 3 years is 88%. And then the next slide, slide 11, now that is more in relation to the specific crime types, or what we may call specialized prosecutions. And this falls under the strategy of prosecuting and resolving criminal cases. In other words, we are saying that there are alternative means, especially through specialization, where we can then achieve successful prosecution. The first one, and there there are 10 performance indicators. The first indicator is conviction rate in the commercial crimes, which is mainly done by the specialized commercial crimes unit. For the 3 year term, we have set our target at 93. And then for conviction rate in organized crime, we have set our target at 90%. For sexual offenses, we have set our target at 69%. And then for conviction rate in trio crimes, we have set our target at 85%. Again, it's important to emphasize that we have shied away from setting extremely stretched targets. If I may then move to the next slide, then that is the fifth performance indicator, which is conviction rate in violent protests. We have set our target at 74%. And then the number of persons convicted of corruption, offenses related to corruption, where the amount involved is more than 5 million. We have set our target initially to 33%, but we have somewhat lowered it down to 26%. We are a little bit optimistic in the... Sorry, it's not 26%, it's numbers, it's not percentages, just the numbers. It's 33, 2017, 2018, but then we have lowered it down to 26. And then the seventh one is the number of government officials convicted for corruption or offenses related to corruption. There again is the numbers. We have actually set somewhat stretch targets there, 210. And then for conviction rate in cybercrime, its percentages, the target is 74%. And then the next slide, that's slide 13, the number of operational care centers. As I've mentioned there, we have reduced our target from 60 in the previous year to 55. And then conviction rate at TCC in reported cases. We have slightly increased our targets there from 2013-2014, but then our estimated performance is 67%. So we think that a target of 68% is fair. Then if I may, then with your permission, Chairperson, then move to the next strategic objective. That is ensuring profit is removed from crime, and that is delivered through the asset forfeiture unit. There are two objective indicators there. And then the first objective indicator is the percentage of completed forfeiture cases. As we have mentioned, as a result of an audit query, we have changed that from numbers to percentages. So the medium-term target is 96% of all the cases received. And then the second objective indicator is the value of completed forfeiture cases. We have actually reduced it downwards, from the previous years. For 2017-2018 is 245 million rands, 2018-2019 282 million rands, 2019 to 2020, 311 million rands. And then the performance indicators, we have seven performance indicators there, slide 15. The first performance indicator is the percentage of freezing orders. As we have mentioned there, we have now actually changed it into percentages. We have set our target at 100%, and we think that that is perfectly achievable. And then the value of freezing orders, there are the figures. They rise from 789 in the first year, 993 in the second year, 1 billion in the third year. And then the value of freezing orders obtained relating to corruption, where the amount involved is more than 5 million rands. Once again there, we gradually increase our target there. The target for 2017-18 is 195 million. The next year, 198, and then the third year, 202 million rands. And then the fourth indicator is the value of recoveries in terms of poker prevention of organized crime act. Once again, we gradually increase our targets there. The target in the first year is 190 million, in the second year, 210 million, and then in the third year, 252 million rands. And then the litigation success rate, as we have indicated there, that we think that that projects more accurately the success rate. We think that a success rate of 93% of all the cases litigated is a fair target. And then the sixth one is the value of recoveries obtained relating to corruption, where the amount involves more than 4 million rand, that is including both proceeds of crime and government losses. Yeah, which is more than 5 million. And the first year there is 60 million, the second year 70 million, the third year 80 million. And then the value of recoveries for government officials convicted of corruption and other related offenses, that is irrespective of the value there. The first year is 400,000 rands, the second year is 500,000 rands, and then the third year is 600,000 rands. And then the third and last strategic objective is ensuring that vulnerable, that's on slide 17. It's ensuring that vulnerable and intimidated persons are successfully protected. That is delivered through the Office for Witness Protection. There's only one objective indicator there, and that is the number of witnesses and related persons harmed, threatened, or killed whilst on the witness program. That is the only area which makes sense to have a zero indicator. Thank you, Chairperson. And then the performance indicator there, again, one on page 18, and that is the percentage of witnesses and related persons that walk off the witness protection. That is those that walk off voluntarily without permission, and it's 1.5%, and that's it. Then if I may then hand over to my colleague Hanike, who will then present the budget expenditure for the benefit of the chairperson and the members, and that will be on slides 20 to slide 33.
see they are in a hurry to ask for money. That's why they change the other conditions. Over to you.
Thank you, Chief. Yes, we are in a hurry to get more funds. You're quite right on that one. The first slide I've got is on slide 20. This is just to show you where we are in the current financial year. If you remember, we've reported an anticipated overspending of 45 million on our personnel budget during our meeting in October. But if we look at this slide now, we have managed to bring the 45 down to only 31 million. And the difference is due of all our resignations we had during the financial year. We did ask additional funding or assistance from our mother department in this regard to assist us with more money, which was declined. We also tried other alternatives to get additional funding, which we didn't exceed in. So what we have done is we've stopped all procurement processes at, in the beginning of January to force saving on our goods and services and our capital budget so that we can fund our personnel budget. Now, during the interactions with National Treasury, they first said they're not going to allow us to borrow money from goods and services to personnel. But later on during the year, they did indicate that they will, for a last once-off rescue plan, they will allow it for the current financial year. So we do have the permission to borrow some of our money up to personnel budget. We will, so if we look at this slide and where we are today, we will break even with our budget allocation. We will manage to stay within our budget. The next slide is the same information, just broken down per sub-program, where we see our four sub-programs. On this slide, you'll see that NPS, we've got an 11 million saving. That is on goods and services, where we've stopped the procurement of new services and goods. In AFU, you'll see there's a 1.2 million saving. This is actually, although it looks good on the presentation, this is still an area of concern for us, because in corporate services, the support services sub-program, we've assisted them with payment of curator fees. Our curator fees is a concern for us. We did an application for CARA funds, but the NDPP has also constituted a task team to look at the payment of our curators and the high amounts that we pay. So we are positive that we will bring the curator expenditure down in the current year. The other our area of concern is our witness protection area, where you can see it's an overspend of 14 million in this area. And this is due to the high operational cost to protect our witnesses that's on the program. Then we'll go to the NTF allocation on slide 23. Is just a high-level increase in our budget, where you see that our NTF budget, we only increased by 5.7% over the median term. The 1920 financial year, we've got a 7.28% increase. This is also the only change on the presentation we did in October, because in October we reported an increase of 5.6%. But National Treasury has revised the 1920 allocation, so we will get a little bit more funding in that outer year that will bring a little bit of relief. But if we look at the coming year, the 2017-18, we've only got a 3.5% increase in our budget allocation, which is currently a big concern for the NPA, because we will not be able to fund the cost of living adjustment. And if you look at the consumer price index of 6.6, and we've only got a 3.56%. So we really have to sharpen up our cost containment measures and stop wherever possible to ensure that we can remain in the next year's budget allocation. The slide 24 is the indication of the MTF budget allocation for sub-program. That is just the same percentage over the financial years. divided into our four sub-programs. Slide 25 is just a graph to show that the bulk, 78% of our budget allocation are allocated to our MPS sub-program, which is the core of the MPS. And then you'll see support services, there's a 13% budget allocation in our support services sub-program, but that is due to centralized services that we pay from support services, such as our IT, our security, accommodations, and so forth. The slide 26 is just the growth for sub-program. Then slide 27 is the same information, just for economic classification, the 3.56%, that's repeated, that's just showing you our allocation for economic classification. On slide 28 is a pie graph that shows us the breakdown between our economic classification. Now this is where our concern also starts. Because if you look at this slide, you will notice that 84.5% of our budget allocation are allocated to our compensation of employees. Now, the norm of the ratio between compensation and goods and services, I think as you will be aware, is 75 versus 25. And we're standing on 84%. Now, in the MPA, this ratio was, during the 2011-12 financial year, we were at 78.23%, which was more in line with the norm. But over the years, and with our environment, all our goods and services up to our personnel budget, it has now bring us to a situation where we are 84% on compensation budget. This is a big concern for us because this is not a perfect situation. So we've got a few people that we can't supply them with the resources all the time. The next slide is just a graph showing the increase. Then if we go to slide number 13, here is where another concern starts. This is now, if we look at our personnel expenditure for the past financial year.
Do you want to hold on a bit? Advocation, do you have an intervention?
Honourable Chairperson? Not at this stage. I'll wait for it to finish and I'll elaborate on one or two aspects. But I thank you, Honourable Chairperson, for affording me the opportunity.
I wanted to give you a break, a breathing space.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, back to slide number 13. If we look at our personnel expenditure for the past financial year, the people that we've currently, all our warm bodies, and we do a projection of the coming financial year, you will see that we're projecting a 36 million shortfall on our personnel budget. Now this is after interventions in our performance bonuses, where we've included a reduction of almost 30%. We are putting measures in place to look at our performance management system and to see if we can decrease the amount we pay in this regard. Now, if we look at this slide and we look at the number of resignations and people leaving the department, we'll have about a 42 million saving on people leaving the department. We lose about an average of 13 people per month. Now, if we bring that into account, we will be able to break even, but we will lose another 100-odd people, and we'll only be able to replace 12 of the 100 people. And then if you can also just to the original budget allocation, in our previous presentations to this committee, we did indicate that our budget allocation was reduced with 156 million for the coming year and then 243 million for the year thereafter. On slide 31, we're showing that what are we still doing to curb our personnel expenditure. Now, in our previous report to this committee, we said that we'll stop filling off posts in our administration department, but that has now gone over to not filling posts overall in the MBA. So we're not even filling critical posts because we don't have the money for that. In line with this, we are continuously seeking ways of doing things better, reorganizing people, reorganizing work to see whether we can cope with the resources we've got without appointing additional resources. The next point that I need to highlight is our aspirant program that we didn't enroll on last year. Now, if we look at the current budget situation, we won't be able to enroll on this program next year. This is a big concern for us because we, as the MBA, won't be able to sustain the organization without our aspirants program. We need to enroll the aspirant program. For that, we need, you'll see the last slide also, we need about 38 million per year for 100 aspirant programs.
I'm sure we all understand what aspirant programs are.
Okay. Should I?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Let me just take a moment to explain what the Aspirant Prosecutors Program is. Annually, the NPA has an intake of applicants, law graduates, some attorneys, some advocates that actually apply to be admitted into the Aspirant Prosecutors Program. This is it's a training program that lasts for a period of 6 months to a year. So we had two intakes, a first half and a second half intake, where they're subjected to rigorous training, actually write tests to prepare them to enter the system from the lower court up. This is critical for us to sustain the institution, to sustain the institution as one of choice and excellence. I find the current situation completely unacceptable. It has major negative repercussions for the future sustainability of the institution if we cannot continue with an aspirant prosecutor's program. We put it on hold last year. We did so strictly for business sense. Business sense in the sense that we had a number of prosecutors that were on contract. Now, we had to balance the amount of aspirant prosecutors and those prosecutors that are in contract to rather fill the positions of the contract employees with the aspirant prosecutors. We've now reached a stage where we have to get back, we have to reinitiate the program to sustain the future of the organization. I've recently appointed a very senior person to take over the entire training of the NPA. So we probably won't be calling it an aspirant prosecutor's program going forward. We'll be calling it something similar to the National Prosecuting Authority Academy. We really want to recruit the best. We want to go to universities, and engage with universities and tell them what the NPA is all about. And we want to recruit the best people. We want the community to be represented by the best people in this country. We want to deliver an excellent service to the citizens of our country. So we feel it's absolutely critical for this program for funds to be found for this program to continue.
If I may add, it's the idea behind it really was along the lines of what you have with respect to the profession itself, candidate attorneys, for example, in the sense that, and this is somewhat what would have been envisaged in the new legal practice regime, in the sense that you needed to have people trained in some way before they get into the actual profession itself. So it was an attempt to actually try and not only skill but also professionalize the service, because currently, in the absence of the program, unless you can get people who have practiced, elsewhere or have had some experience with practice in either ways. You can only, and it's very difficult to get those people, you can only rely on those who have just graduated. So you take graduates who have no experience at all, and then you have to kind of throw them into the field. And that's the whole idea.
Honorable Chairperson, there's just one critical issue I wish to raise. We were also really mindful of the legacy of the past. People who made sacrifices, you know, to put their brothers, sisters, and siblings through university, and they made sacrifices by going to work. Eventually, they obtained their degrees, and they too would want to work for the NPA. They too would want to practice as lawyers. They too want to deliver a service and give back to the community. So we look at a portion of the intake to recruit some of those people into the NPA. Mm-hmm. So that I thought it was critical that we inform the committee of that approach that we've taken.
I think that's what people would call visionary leadership of the institution, because you have other departments, for instance, who would close teachers' training colleges, and then after 10 years they come back and say, we don't have teachers, but they close the college. And others go and close nursing colleges, come back and say, we don't have nurses. So I think that members of this committee should really support especially the idea of the academy, so that we don't really work piecemeal. It's a very brilliant proposal that we have, because we also have unemployed law graduates roaming the streets, and you can take those graduates and put them into an academy. And maybe that's where partnerships with the private sector should come in, because they don't want crime, and they must put their mouth where the, what do they have, what's that phrase? But thank you very much. Sorry, Abigail, for interrupting.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, we, on slide 32 is just the impact of the reduction of our compensation budget. Now, as I've mentioned previously, that we lose an average of 13 people per month. So our personnel numbers have dropped from 4,983 in April to 4,882 in January, which is about 100 people less than what we started the financial year. So if we continue with this and we lose another 100 in the coming year, it will have a major impact on our performance, as we've actually already seen in the previous presentation. Now, going with that is just another, in the slide I've just highlighted, that except the performance that's going to be hampered, we've got also the employee wellness that's going to increase because of the stress that those people need to cope with, and the absentees that we're going to sit with because the people won't be able to handle the stress. So this is really a big concern currently for us. And then on the last slide is just a forward funding need that we want to highlight again. This was also reported in October. We're not changing this. We did requested this as part of our NCF last year, but it wasn't successful. So we will continue to seek additional funding only for our staffing establishment in our new DPP offices in Polokwane and Mpumalanga, and then, as mentioned now before, the aspirin program that is a very high priority for us. And that's the end of the budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That's short and sweet. I just want to know something. This Tudivela centers, who works there?
Honorable Chairperson, I'm going to request Advocate Toko Machakweni to respond to that question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. The Tudivela Care Center is staffed by a number of professionals. The professionals from the medical arena, which would be your doctors and your nurses. From the social development, it would be your social workers. From the NPA, the three people that we have staffed the Drusilla centers with are one, the victim assistant person, who assists the victim as they come in, because our motto is transitioning the victims into survivors. So we've got the victim assistant officer, we've got the site coordinator, who actually manages the services in the center and actually keeps the record of the times and also the minimum standards that we're supposed to keep in the center. The third person is the case manager, who serves as the liaison within the criminal justice process, making sure that we have the cases being trial ready as well as court ready in terms of the evidence being there and also in time. We have strict rules around the time that it must take for a case to be dealt with, from the reporting time until the case is finalized, which is 9 months. Ideally, that is what we want. Of course, cases will differ according to their demands upon the resources of the country. So those are the people that are there. The investigators come in immediately, a rape victim presents or a domestic violence presents at the center. But they're not necessarily at the center, but the others are at the center.
I put this question because one hears a lot about unemployable graduates. And the question is, how do we go and have a graduation ceremony and slaughter goats and to celebrate the achievement of people who are unemployable? So there must be something wrong there. Now, from your description, it suggests to me that if we were have to have community service for students, that is compulsory, we attach social work students, psychology students, psychiatry students, and law students to your TC centers, you would produce better qualified graduates. We say others must go to advice centers, spend some time, come to the TC centers, so that we produce the youth that are employable. Otherwise, I can't see how we can take the country forward. But I am really impressed. I think you are organized to be able to implement some of these things. But in your DG forums, it would be important that you take these ideas in there. And then we also engage the universities, because there is this so-called academic freedom. But the taxpayer cannot pay people to be so equipped but be so irrelevant to the needs of the country. So I think that academic freedom must be reviewed. It shouldn't mean the right to do what they want regardless of the needs of the country. But thank you very much.
Thank you,
sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to comment on a few issues raised by Ms. Hanneke van Zyl during her presentation. Although we've taken a decision not to fill vacant posts, even critical posts, I've recently reevaluated the position where I've given instructions that critical posts must be filled, and I've requested the directors of public prosecution to submit to me critical posts. And, you know, how do we define the criteria around what is really critical is, you know, we look at what the impact of that area would be, or that particular office would be, and under the administration of justice in the event that position is not filled. We also look at the duration that the position has been vacant for, and the sustainability that's taken place during that period when that position was vacant. And of course, you know, we promote equitable utilization of resources. You know, there's always a famous saying, spread the wealth.
so too must we spread the work, or the workload, to be more precisely. So that's really critical for us, going forward. Asset forfeiture unit, during the course and scope of the responsibilities and execution of their mandate, is required to utilize the services of curators. In most instances, this is really out of their hands. But the costs incurred as a result of the use of curators is absolutely humongous. Now, I've constituted a task team to look at that, to see how can we bring down those costs. So they are working on a submission to me, and I await their submission in earnest, so we can see how we can bring down those costs, because that money can be utilized elsewhere in the administration of justice. CARA funds do assist. Strangely enough, when I leave here this afternoon, I'm actually going directly to a CARA meeting because I'm part of the committee that considers how funds need to be distributed, and we are sitting this afternoon. With regards to the Office for Witness Protection, that's really one aspect that's out of our control. You don't have control over the amount of witnesses that need to come voluntary onto the program and or their related persons. The cost can increase astronomically annually. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Honourable members, let's take hands. Let me start right at the end, Honourable Horn, Honourable Short, Honourable Mutapo, Honourable Pumuan. Honourable Bongo, Honourable Matthias, in that order, Honourable Jackie. Okay, proceed, Honourable.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thank you to the team for the presentation. Chair, allow me to first of all raise a few questions, maybe rather in respect of what the NPA today have not said than what they have said, given the recent history of the NPA. First of all, let's start off with the possible prosecution of the Minister of Finance, Mr. Pravin Gordhan, in respect of the so-called SARS rogue unit.
I can see Honourable Bunwan has concerns. I want to allow him to say what he wants to say.
I'm not sure the relevance of that into the presentation that is being here. And I don't believe that we need to enter into political dimensions at this stage. I want to object to such a question, with due respect.
There is an objection?
Well, yes, Chair, obviously you might be in need of a ruling. Let me first of all say that the issue of the possible prosecution of Minister Gordhan and others in respect of the so-called SARS rogue unit is within the domain of this committee already, having been briefed on it as late as early November last year. Secondly, it's quite interesting that the Honourable Mpulwana says that we should not enter into politics here. And that's precisely why this must be raised, to ensure also that possible prosecutions are not politically motivated. And that's within the ambit of our oversight function and duty to take these matters up once again with the National Director. So I would venture to say that I have the right as well as the duty to raise these matters, even if it is an inconvenient situation for other members.
I guess as a lawyer, you know that if there are reasonable grounds that a crime has been committed, the appropriate institution will institute criminal proceedings. Now, if Parliament is going to enter and put itself into the shoes of the national prosecution and even preempt the work that they may be going to do, I think we are going to begin then to blur the relationships, and I don't think that that would be in the interest of the administration of justice in this country. Honorable Sort.
Chair, maybe to help that, you know, this is a matter that has served before us, and I'm sure the NDPP could respond as far as he is prepared to at this stage with what is before him, because you will remember when we had a lengthy engagement with Advocate Abrams previously, there was the two issues which was broadly in the public domain, the first prosecution that was withdrawn and then the possibility of the second. So it's purely as we are engaging, we will be engaging in a lot of issues relating to prosecutions, possible prosecutions, and it's then within the domain of the NPA to, as far as he is prepared to answer, because obviously we're talking about budget, we're talking about various issues. I don't think it's necessarily an intervention from our side, and if the NDP feels at all that it's political interference from our side, then he's entitled to raise that, but it's purely to get some clarity on that issue, and it might be a very simple question, but if you rule against that one, then it prevents us raising a lot of other broader issues which will relate to the budget, and that's a massive concern from my side and how we are allocating. So there's a very fine line as to what degree, and so I'd ask your wisdom in this regard to possibly allow that question, and then for the NDP to as far as he is prepared to respond, that might be a fair way.
I don't want to move before I hear other members. I have my position, but I'm not hesitant. I'm going to allow others to comment on it. Honorable Major.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to second what Honorable Mpumlana raised. To say that today what we expect is the annual performance plan. Maybe what we could actually entertain as a committee of parliament is principle that's based on policy related to your mandate, rather than attempt to go into specific cases, because if we're going to have to go into specific cases, what criteria are we going to apply in terms of choosing which cases would actually want to put a lens on? And it becomes fair if we actually just look at principle, if there's principle to look at, principle that's guided by policy in relation to the mandate, so that it shouldn't appear as if, for some reason, the kind of questions that we are asking are just for political grandstanding. I think that is fair enough.
I think we are dealing with highly qualified lawyers led by Advocate Abraham. He knows what is permissible and what is not permissible in the law. I am going to leave that in his good hands to deal with that matter.
May I then continue, Chair?
No, I'm going to allow you.
But I've not even asked my question.
No, I have not allowed you to ask the question. I'm not going to allow you to put any further question.
No, then I'm not finished on the matter then. The fact is, Chairperson, this committee has been briefed on this. This committee has requested the presence of Mr. Abrams previously.
Let me help you. Let me help you without suppressing you.
Yes.
I think before we go forward, I just want Advocate Abrahams to tell us his limitations or otherwise on this question that we're raising.
But I don't want to ask him anything that it's with outside of what he's already proffered in public before.
No, don't speak for him. I don't want to speak for him.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. The reality is that the matter is not serving before me. The matter is under investigation by the by the police, and until that investigation is finalized, a decision must be made. My powers are powers of review. I'd like to stop at that. Thank you.
I think now we are all clear what the situation is, and we can also sit here without having heard from the police, try to preempt what the police are doing. So can now we proceed to put questions on the basis of the reports before us, because these reports reflect what we have invited the NPA to appear and do before us.
Yeah, well, thank you, Chair. I will continue. Let me just also say that I don't know what the fears of members of the committee is, but actually the National Director has answered my question by saying that the investigation has been finalised, so thank you for that.
I just want to correct that.
I think, you see, it is said that to err is human. And Honourable Horn is a human being, so he has erred and he accepts the error. Okay, thank you very much.
You just need to correct. That's an ongoing investigation.
Just correct it on record. Correct him on record, Honorable Sir.
No. I think just the NDP wants you to correct that because you can be corrected.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Just for clarity's sake, the investigation by the South African Police Services Priority Crime Investigating Unit, the AUCS, is still ongoing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Let me continue. Let me go to the operational structure of the NPA. When Mr. Abrams took over, he informed the committee as to certain changes he made to the operational structure at the time. Since then, we have seen that two of his deputies have been, I think, if I'm not to err again, on own request on special leave. Now, I want to just get a feedback in respect of what the position is, because we all know there was first the judgment in respect of their competency to continue to be advocates, and now there's an appeal pending. So I think the committee needs some feedback regarding what is now the position of Mr. Mukhwebe and Advocate Jiba, whether they're still on special leave, and then secondly, if so, whether they have it all returned to work at some stage. And then thirdly, given the fact that we are under the very seriously under the impression of the budgetary constraints of the NPA, whether the NPA has looked into withholding remuneration pending the appeal, because the situation obviously is now quite different since a competent court has struck them from the role of advocates, although there is an appeal. We all know that in labour law there might then be a situation where remuneration may be withheld, and whether the NPA has looked into that and if that is the case. Then, Chair, going on,
I would appeal that we must just be tolerant and allow members space to put their questions. And as I said, we are dealing with highly qualified, experienced prosecutors. They know what is relevant and what is not relevant. And if some of us put irrelevant things, they will be free to ignore what is irrelevant. Proceed, Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your, even though it might be seen as backhanded protection, your protection nonetheless. then, Chair, going on the issue of the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, we have seen the Minister of State Security at the beginning of this month indicating that he is very worried about state security, and also then going for ahead and saying that there may be a need to regulate social media. And we all know that in terms of the real functions of the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, one of their duties is to advise on issues of state security. So the question is whether either before the minister made these statements or thereafter, whether there has been interaction with the minister regarding this plans of the minister to regulate social media. And, well, maybe generally speaking, in terms of the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, whether the officials of the NPA dealing or staffed, situated at that unit, have regular meetings and for what purpose with the minister. Then, Chair, coming really to the presentation today, I must say that even though we as a committee must have sympathy for the NPA in respect of the downward trend in their performance given the budgetary constraints they are faced with, certain questions, in my view, must be answered in respect of targets and indicators. You touched on the issue of the TTCs, the Zala Care Centres, and I must say that I just want reaction from the NPA on this issue, that to my mind it doesn't make sense that if one has gone through the expense of setting up these care centres to then reduce the numbers. There must obviously be a cost involved in closing them down again. So the downward target of having 60 in place to 55, I think, needs to be explained to us. In respect of conviction rates generally, Chair, I think the comment must be made that It must be of a worry that the underperformance in a current financial year is then used to determine targets going forward. Maybe I'm just speaking personally, but maybe also on behalf of the committee, that one would rather see, and Dr. Ramahidi has referred to stretch targets, that targets are maintained, and as the saying goes, that you shoot for the stars but maybe settle for the moon. But the way it is encapsulated in the ABP this year must lead to the question whether the NPA is prepared to settle for mediocre performance and then brand that as reaching targets. And if we are serious in the fight of crime, I don't think that's really the way to go. Then, Chair, going on...
To speak personally and not on behalf of the committee, rather as a member of the committee.
I said I speak personally, but I would hope I have the support of other committee members.
Oh, okay.
That's what I said. Chair, another example of this is, for example, the issue on slide 12 there of the number of government officials convicted of corruption and then the cyber crime prosecution success rate, where there's a huge scale underperformance and then the target, even though a bit higher, is still nothing near the 2013-14 performance. And I think in the fight against corruption, that must be questioned. In respect of the cyber crimes prosecution, Chair, the question is really whether we can be, given the fact that we will also be dealing with the cyber crimes bill as a committee and as parliament this year, just have an indication from the NPA also to enable us to maybe prioritise this bill as to whether the downward trend in convictions is really must be ascribed to the absence of a proper legislative framework. Then, Chair, on slide 14 there, in respect of the performance of the asset forfeiture unit, I think we're in need of an explanation, and I want to also make a personal comment in this regard, that it would seem that the target set is even on last year's performance only in line with this year's performance. And then, Chair, I want to put it to the National Director that quite possibly he do not need to reinvent the wheel in respect of the asset forfeiture unit, because to the best of my knowledge he still has the services of Mr. Hofmeyer, who I think previously led the AFU to very successful years in functioning, and whether it mustn't be contemplated taking Mr. Hofmeyer back there, also specifically given the fact that he's put it on record in Parliament that at the moment he feels underutilised where he is.
I just want to make a request. I have an industrial relations group. Now, if just put in my questions and I go, then get.
I thought it's a point of order, because otherwise I have to allow you to finish.
Well, I have to.
Can I
interrupt
you?
Thank you very much. I just want to ask from NPA just the comment on the turnaround period that they have problems if they do. I understand that there are quite a number of cases where people are awaiting trial for a longer period. Do you have a statistics on that, and do you have any plan to try and alleviate that position? Secondly, I just wanted to find out the use of video conferencing in postponing cases, particularly on the cases where the prisoners are a risk. And also, thirdly, on the comment on the use of the African languages in courts, how do you think that can be, as a participant in the court proceedings, what's your comment on that? Would you encourage that? If so, what are problems? Those are the three things.
You don't have to. Are you done?
Yes, I am.
You don't have to wait for the answer, because the answer is for the committee. You'll find it on record.
Thank you very much.
Honorable Horn, I'm not quite comfortable with what you were trying to do. Making a recommendation to the NPA to appoint or keep in employment people, because we don't want to discuss the suitability or otherwise of individuals in this committee. I think the NPA understand labor laws, and when they appoint people, they will have regard to those labor laws. So I'm not going to allow you to proceed with that question.
Well, the question has been asked, but I'm in any event going on with other questions. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I have another three or four. Thank you. We're here for the day, aren't we? Yeah, no, thank you. Okay, then on slide 12, Chair, with your permission, the same questions regarding targets also beg in respect of the value of freezing orders for amounts more than 5 million and value of recoveries in terms of the so-called POCA Act, the Prevention of Organized Crime Act.
I
specifically have another a very important question in respect of the personnel situation.
Also a very important question.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do...
But we have the full day set aside.
Now, let me assist you. I'm going to ask you to stop there. I will take the second round. So I'm not suppressing you. The next speaker is Honorable Salt.
Thank you, Chairperson. And at the outset, I think one does need to again express our gratitude for the work that the NPA has done and the NDPP under very difficult budgetary constraints. And I think in our questioning, one of the easiest answers when we talk about targets and achievements is the answer is, but you're not giving us enough capacity to do the work. So that caveat, obviously we need to exercise a degree of oversight and questioning about targets and achievements within what we as Parliament appropriate, the funding. So it is again, Chair, we've indicated it in our previous reports that we are concerned about the funding for the NPA. And we unfortunately need to bear that in mind when we ask certain questions. Now, just with that background, there was a recent the meeting on illicit flows, Advocate Abrams, which you referred to, and the meeting that you had with various portfolio committees, and where the Finance Committee, now I wear another hat, and that is as an alternate member of the Finance Committee, said that it seems that the SAPS did not act in cases of suspicious transactions reported to it by the Financial Intelligence Centre, and even if the SAPS did act, it was not clear that the NPA had the capacity to follow up the cases. Now, when we passed that act, the Financial Intelligence Centre Act, and the amendment to that act, it was seen as a massive weapon in the fight against corruption and the illicit flows of funds. And Mr. Karim indicated that there does not appear to be an obvious deterrent for this. And there was also concerns about flow of funding on planes and cash flow that doesn't seem to be properly addressed. So it raises a number of issues of capacity both with the NPA and of course with the detectives. And that is one of the issues with the police as well, the level of investigations that you're receiving. What can one expect, bearing in mind your capacity constraints, to improve that aspect where the Financial Intelligence Centre, which is under an obligation and where banks are under an obligation to report suspicious transactions, what are we experiencing? And that's the first question. And then the second question, when we dealt with the Protected Disclosures Act, there are a number of provisions in that act to protect whistleblowers, and also but there's a more important provision in the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act that obliges state officials to disclose any corruption or suspicious activity where there's more than 100,000 rand and there's a penalty there. To your knowledge, has there ever been a prosecution arising from that obligation of government officials where you become aware. You might not even be aware, you might not be involved in it, but you become aware of, and we know the level of, and I'm going to phrase it very carefully, corrupt, wasteful, and irregular expenditure together, where it's tens of billions of rands, but one would have expected complaints to have been laid with the police, and I appreciate that you are on the receiving end, so you await dockets to come to you of investigations, but surely this is something that needs to be made more aware, the Financial Intelligence Center and the provisions of the Corruption Act, where you have DGs receiving forensic reports and then not reporting it. And we had the incident in the SABC inquiry where a person came and gave evidence to Parliament that they were aware of 100 million rands worth of corruption, but it was never reported. And then the minister correctly said that, well, you're now saying that, you should be charged because you never reported this. But obviously that person was giving evidence to Parliament, so they can't be charged, they're protected.
Mm.
But that just illustrates the fact that there are, we as Parliament have passed a lot of laws, and the challenge is the implementation, and again, understandably, the capacity constraints that you are sitting under. But those would be very helpful if you'd like to comment on that, the greater efficiency. Then tied up with that,
as long as we are not suggesting that what happened in the SABC has necessarily happened with it.
No, I'm just saying that as an example. Yes, and I'm not asking for a comment on that particular,
that's
illustration. Then when one looks at the asset forfeiture, and I think my colleague, Mr. Horn, did point out some of the concerns about the changes in the targets, and maybe you'd be able to unpack that a little bit more, because it seems that the targets have been reduced, and where we saw their best years were 2014-15, where we had billions of rands worth of freezing orders, of valuable recoveries, and it seems to be substantially reduced. And I'm just trying to understand those slides as well, because one does seem to see an increase in corrupt, wasteful, irregular expenditure, and then one would have thought that your targets and your performances would be along those lines, but it does appear that with the reduction of your targets that we might well be, are we not losing the war when it comes to that? Again, bearing in mind your capacity constraints. The next issue relates to the change of the reporting when it comes to collapsing convictions and your ADMs into one. Now, in the past, we found it very helpful to see to how many cases have been finalized through alternative dispute mechanisms, as opposed to verdicts that have been obtained. And it was helpful to us to see, and whilst we're not detracting from the usage of plea bargaining and those to finalize cases, sometimes it has been. So maybe you could just explain further, or would that information still be available to us to get an idea? The third aspect there relates to the numbers of withdrawals of cases as well, which also helps us to ascertain in the broader scope, when you take the whole ambit of the criminal justice system, from the number of complaints that are laid with the police, to the number of arrests, to the number of case dockets that are prepared, to the number of case dockets that are withdrawn then, for whatever reason, and often it is for lack of proper investigation. But that is obviously also helpful to us. Then, Chair, just the issue of court performance targets no longer being reflected, and that's an issue for us to engage with the Office of the Chief Justice. It's not the NPA, but it does make it more difficult for the NPA to account, because where previously we could say, but here there are less convictions, but on the other hand the courts are sitting for less hours, and that's beyond the control of the NPA. So that is an important issue, where last year it was a reduction, I think, of 7% of court hours sat. That is beyond the control, but it impacts on their performance. And I think we need to bear that in mind, and we need to, when we engage with the Office of the Chief Justice, for them to say, but how do we, as oversight of the NPA, of Legal Aid Board, they all might have a reduction in their performance because the court hours, the courts are sitting less. So it is not, it's just an observation, and it's an issue which we will need to raise with the Office of the Chief Justice. Absolutely, Chair. But it's important for us to note that when we are considering performance and how well the NPA is doing. Similarly, the concerns of Legal Aid South Africa, where they indicated due to financial constraints they might not be able to have legal representatives in court, which would lead to a postponement of the cases. Maybe that's a specific question that you could comment on. Are you experiencing that in your courts where Legal Aid, due to a reduction in their budget, that there's a spike in postponements, which will obviously then impact on your conviction rates again? Chair, I don't want to take up too much time because I think we'll have a second round as well. So thank you. I'll reserve the rest for the second round. Thank you, Chair.
Must thank you for your pointed questions, short and sweet, because it's important that the public is also able to follow what we're talking about, because the matters we are dealing with are matters of concern. Honorable Mutapo.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members and DPP. Thank you so much for your presentation. I've got a few questions and remarks to make. The issue of reduction of Tutisela care centers is of much concern to me, the target 60 to 55. Don't you think this is going to have an is contradicting the NPA's efforts in fighting gender-based violence? I during my oversight, I went to Mangweng Hospital. I'm really impressed. The Tutisela Care Center, they were taken care of. So I'm a bit concerned when you started saying the reduction of target from 60 to 55. Your comment on that. And what differentiate between TCC, Tutisela Care Centers, and Victim Empowerment Centers, which are normally based in police stations? Because it appears the modus operandi appear to be secondly, Chairperson, the NPA's prosecutors, well-trained and equipped and skilled to tackle the scourge of racism, which nowadays is rearing its ugly head. There are nasty comments which are made. Madam Helen Zille, longing for colonization, saying it was better, there were better infrastructure and so forth. Other guy calling blacks baboons. You see. Then Madam Kolabanat again, and Sparrow. So, in lieu that the Parliament is now busy with the hate crime bill. So is the prosecution also moving along that? The Chairperson, I need to be protected, ne?
Against
my right hand side. Yes. Because you know, except Matthias. Matthias. Yes. You know, I'm on stage and they are busy talking and apparently commenting on what I'm saying. I need to be protected because we are all honorable members here. When honorable members were busy asking questions, we kept quiet as honorable members. So they need to reciprocate. Please.
Vertel, Helen. Alsjeblieft toch.
Jack, wel iets kan ons horen wat ze gaan zeggen.
Oké. Honorable Hon, can you see what you are doing now?
What you
took all of us off the track, giving me the kinds of questions that you are asking. I think we need to actually go back to the APP so that we can engage the NPA on APP. So please, I do know that to some extent this might have been influenced by the type of questions that were not really necessary that were asked by Honorable Horn. But let's remember what the purpose of this meeting is and go back to the annual performance plan so that we can be in the position to meaningfully engage the
I want to sustain that and say I think the hate crime bill will be coming to this committee. And those matters that may be falling within the ambit of that, we'll deal with them when the bill is here. So can we return to...
And we'll hopefully be referred to our for prosecution.
Exactly, yeah.
By that time.
Yeah. Or you are sensitizing them.
Yes.
Okay.
No, fortunately I'm not... reacting to what Honorable Rwanda is saying.
No, you have been covered by Advocate Marama.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Advocate.
You are a good advocate.
Secondly, thirdly, Chairperson, Maroche were trained all over, in all eight provinces, except Western Cape. Nationally, being NPA program on gender-based violence, very good. It was a train-the-trainer program. This issue I raise now and then when NPA appears before this honorable committee. Now I would like to know, because I forgot the slide number. You made mention of fighting gender-based violence. Honorable Matthias yesterday raised the issue. So I would like to know, have the project Davesita, it was called Project Davesita. You remember we even queried the naming sort of. So has it stopped? So what about those trained Maoshi? They are well equipped to deal with it. Why can't we sort of utilize that them in TCCs, in Tutizela Care Centers and elsewhere? Because I'm aware that in terms of Domestic Violence Act, cases are arising out of Domestic Violence Act may not be tried at Maroshi's chorus, at traditional courts. So may you kindly comment on that, Metoko Majokwen. And
I'm aware that the Sajay deals with the training. Now, I wanted to believe that traditional courts, regardless of what people think are courts, should in the curriculum be dealt with there to avoid all these things. Then we will have Tobela curriculum, Davesita curriculum, until we don't know what we're talking about. Shouldn't the curriculum be referred to that structure?
Fortunately, Chair, the Office of Chief Justice himself is very much passionate about that. Yes. I used to serve in Sajay by virtue of being the then Deputy Chairperson of National House of Traditional Leaders, and he was hands-on on the issue. Maybe on because NPA is also... No, that one relates to NEEC. Maybe they can play a part in that regard, because the curriculum really is as you suggest, is busy being developed in conjunction with National House of Traditional Leaders. So I really think what you are saying does carry water.
Yeah, I serve in this committee. Maybe the NPA should identify their needs and then refer that to Sajay, so that when the curriculum is developed, your concerns are taken on board. Proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got another comment or question in terms of powers and duties of National Director. In terms of Section 22, Subsection 2C of enabling legislation, National Prosecution Act, there are certain very important duties NDPP, which you are to perform. Now, I would like you to, because there are perceptions of you said to be interfering in some cases. So please, clarify the nation, not us, regarding the powers granted to you in terms of Section 22, Subsection 2C of the said legislation. And I'm also concerned about the overspending of 14809, Dr. Ramayide, on the Office of the Witness Protection Unit. Yes. Please, relating to high operational costs. May you kindly also unpack that. And the ratio 84 to 16, emanating from 2011, it was 78, 22. And then, now, here under review is COE 84, 16, which is, has ballooned and surpassed the norms and standards set. So I also request to have a...
We apply the same rule as we apply to...
But it was for only four. His were nine. And then... were nine. This is the last one, the fifth. His were nine. I was noting. Yes. Baya, thank you. So, another thing is, in presenting, I don't know whether it's a... Advocate Ramayide or Advocate Majokwe, we are losing personnel. So I don't know. Losing how? Are they leaving NPA or through act of nature or what? Because it was just a very loose term. More especially taking into consideration that most of the budget goes to COE, compensation of employees. So please comment on that. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you for the court and wonder for your report. Honorable Maila.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks, Advocate Abrams and the team for their presentations. Chair, the National Prosecuting Authority is a very important role player in the integrated justice system. You know, fortunately, this committee also is also responsible for correctional services. One of the major problems that we face is overcrowding in correctional centers. Now, in your presentation, Advocate Abrams, you indicated that there are challenges around case flow management. And that is one issue which exacerbates the issue of overcrowding. So I wanted to check how much are we doing in ensuring that the case flow management is managed efficiently. In your presentation again, you indicated the keenness of the NPA on a victim-centric approach. And my little worry was, I thought I was hearing you to be more focused on the victims without indicating how the offenders are held accountable and how do we manage to have peace in the communities where both the victims and the offender come from? Again, in your presentation, you indicated how the NPA is fighting this culture of corruption in government and in the private sector. Now, my observation of over the years is that we celebrate corruption, we celebrate how we deal with corruption if it affects the public sector. But if it's in the private sector, sometimes it's written in very small letters. Now, I want you to highlight some cases of corruption from the private sector, which were dealt with by the National Prosecuting Authority.
Without suggesting
that we must...
No, no. Okay. Without suggesting that we must not focus on the public sector. Yes, yes. The Criminal Procedure Act makes provision for private prosecution. Now, in the recent past, the AfriForum, which I suppose I'm correct, is a right-wing rights group, has launched a dedicated private prosecution unit headed by the former state prosecutor, Gerinel. Do we need to be excited? Is this going to bring changes to the private prosecution regime? I just want to know that. Now, Dr. Ramaj,
doesn't the law allow private prosecution?
It does.
And if it does, should we question the right of members of society who want to avail themselves of it?
No, that's not my question, Chairperson. I'm not questioning why members of society should be able to do that. You see, in the media space, it is projected as if, since the AfriForum has created this unit, then it seems as if there is going to be radical changes in the prosecuting sector. I want to know if this thing is actually coming up with very new radical interventions into the private prosecution.
You say the challenge is that maybe the question is so political, because someone may say these ones are right wing, and they can say that you are left wing. Now, what is that going to? Where is that going to leave us? Should the committee then weigh things in terms of who is right wing and who is left wing? Thank you. Proceed. I leave it in your good hands.
I don't get what you're saying. But obviously, AfriForum is right wing. Very right. Maybe I'm left wing or middle wing. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, Dr. Ramait, in one of... In the presentation, you indicated that you are targeting a 0% of witnesses harmed.
In
the right way. Yes, the target on witnesses harmed, threatened, or killed whilst in the witness protection
program, we are targeting a 0%. Now,
But then in
the same breath, there are those who walk away, who walk off the witness protection program. And there we are targeting 1.5%. Now I wonder why in that particular area do we have to target 1%? Why don't we just target 0% in both? Your explanation will be.
Advocate Ramaite,
there's nothing wrong to what you did. Because you see, we're communicating also to the outside world. And if there is a slip of the tongue, which may send a wrong information, there's nothing wrong in intervening. I think Honorable Maile is a seasoned politician, he would understand that.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you very much, Advocate Chuan, for the presentation. I think I want to join Honorable Swart that about my gratitude too for the kind of work that we are doing in the office. I think I share with you that since you have taken office, the NPA is stabilized. And continue that good work that we are doing in the office. Maybe taking it from, or taking it from where my layers left it. Comrade Mail, around the issue of this AfriForum having to appoint one of the colleagues who used to work for NPA. From the media space, Chairperson, I think there was a doubt that was a bit casted that on the public prosecution itself in favor of private prosecution. So I would just be interested to get your comment, the extent to which that has affected either the morale in the public or in the morale in the staff around that particular matter, because as we have said that we need to build a huge confidence around the public that the public prosecutions is the only way to go for any other prosecution that is there in the country.
That message. Professional lawyers don't have a choice as to where they want to operate. Can we really prescribe that if you are a prosecutor, you can't go into private prosecution? Do you want to go that far?
Not really, Chair. I think it was unprecedented that you live at that level and go to a civil society organization that would simply just focus on that specific matter. Because to me, it begin to raise a suspicion of what other people are raising as a regime change, that there is an element that seeks to want to affirm the issue of trying to take everything from the state to be private.
We shouldn't make the NPA descend into a political arena. We are entitled as politicians to hold that view or another view, but we must not lead them into temptation. Thank you.
Part of the issues that were raised by Honorable Horn around the indicators and targets, I think in the main, if you check at page number 10,
they may be influenced by the fact that you see at the page 10, High Court conviction rate in courts, High Court 1814 says 88, 1415 says 91, 1516 says 90, then the projection in terms of the medium term targets, then it starts to say 87. I think that as you come for quarterly, it may create problems for us in terms of us having to gauge in terms of what we've done, because you can see it fluctuates from all the previous financial years up to now. So to have a projection that goes down, it may create a problem, because you may either go down or go up. So when you come here, then you will find questions like the ones that Honorable Horn was raising, and that may create a problem. So my view is that we may need to find a way, because it's a projection. Make that projection 100% on its own, because you don't know whether it will go down, so that when you go to the actual, you're able to say this is what we've been able to achieve, than to give a specific number of a projection of a future target. I think you may just have to look at that. And
what Honorable Bongo is doing is peer review. So I'm happy that you accept it.
Well, I want, maybe he must come and sit this side every day, because then he can act in a more independent manner rather than just towing the party line.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, Honorable Bongo.
So I think we may have just to look at that, the projections of the future target. Now, what we always raise, as you see now, the alternative dispute resolutions. You are saying we are now going to match that with the, we are now going to be reporting about it independently. I think from where I'm sitting, alternative dispute resolution is the future. It's very important. If we are to deal with alternative dispute resolutions, were to cut off a lot of the backlog that is there, including the to assist in terms of the case flow management. One matter that also worries me, that I want us to deal with, this freezing orders. I want to know how much is involved, the extent to which turnaround strategy in terms of having to resolve those cases, so we've frozen accounts of people, because if I can just imagine, if we can freeze my account, I can die immediately. So the turnaround strategy in terms of, because we can't have a situation where...
Which accounts are you referring to? Are they private accounts or
public?
Counts, Honorable Bongo, it's freezing amounts that are seen to be proceeds of crime. So an entire account is not frozen, but an amount that's deemed equivalent to the amount identified as the proceeds of crime. And that amount can vary, from zero, of course you can't freeze zero, but from anything from 1 rand to, of course, millions of rands. And possibly billions.
So you won't be affected because you don't have.
I'm just worried about the turnaround, because they are being frozen, and they are still subject of an allegation, generally.
They are frozen
as part of the operation.
I agree with that, but I'm just saying the turnaround, because you can't freeze an amount for 10 years.
Going too far, because we ourselves are saying that there are delays in the system. That's why we need integrated justice system to speed up things. So before we get our act together, we can't say be talking time frames.
And the other matter that I want to comment on,
is 72% of prosecution on sexual offences. I think that I would like to commend you on, and we need to generally make sure that we increase that kind of performance. And I want your comment on the issue of the OSD. I think it has been a complaint rising in the state attorneys and so on. So I know prosecutors are also from the dispensation of the OSD. So I want to know the extent to which it is affecting your unit. And then lastly, the case flow. I just wanted to comment on the turnarounds, the general turnarounds, because if somebody has appeared generally, because I know, I think it's last year, there is a case that appeared of an honorable member, so I see, and now it's, I don't know, when is it coming back again, what is the turnaround? Because it will be in my interest to see that case getting quicker and being finalized. Thank you, Chair.
The honorable member. Which honorable member?
The honorable member, Breitenberg.
I don't think we should venture into selective justice. All accused persons must be treated equally, regardless of their station in life. So I think that's a matter that I don't think we should use this forum to do.
No, but what I'm saying, I want to know how the case flow management operates, case flow management in the turnarounds. That's why I did not mention names, but now you are asking me about the name, then you don't comment after that. I think it's a bit unfair, because I was making a general statement on the turnarounds.
Let's get the Honorable Majake, maybe she will put me right.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I do support your notion that maybe we shouldn't actually engage a discussion around the case of the Honorable Member of the DA, Janice Breitenberg, in this committee. With the NPA now. Let's give you space to deal with it as a committee.
Like we will give them space to deal with all cases, and we don't want to stand in the arena of prosecution. All that we must agree is that all accused persons must be equal before the law, and I think that the NPA understand that we are governed by the rule of law, and the human rights of the accused persons involved. So I agree with you, Honorable Rojake. Are you done, Honorable Bogo?
Yes,
Honorable Mainja, can you speak for us?
You mean Matthias or Mainja?
Matthias.
Well, thanks, Honorable Chair. Look, it's quite unfair. Disingenuous on Honorable Maila in his absence on Honorable Bongo. To choose the freedom of AfriForum of being what it is, the right wing formation, when they are more inclined as the ruling party to share platform with the AfriForum than to share platform with anyone else who's on the left of them and as well as the AfriForum, just in passing. So that is very disingenuous. Because I can show that there is here a press conference with the AfriForum.
I did say yesterday,
and I want to repeat it, that the public is not interested in inter-party fights. They want us to address their issues, and this committee must confine itself to addressing matters that are in the best interest of the public, not party quarrels, but you said it was in passing. I will excuse you like I excuse the other system.
Okay, no, thanks, Honorable Chair. Look, I welcome Advocate Abraham's commitment to look into causes and effect of crime and victims of crime in relation to challenges of economic exclusion, because that underlines the importance of not only focusing on the reduction of crime, combating of crime, but also eliminating socio-economic causes of crime through social intervention. So that is most welcome. I think in most countries, criminal justice system has NPA as a component of that instrument. In most countries, the criminal justice system tends to focus on two key primary strategic strategies to reduce crime. One is to remove as many criminals as possible from society, hence we've got overcrowding in our correctional centers. Remove them, even if you don't know where you're going to offload them. That's first. Second is to eliminate immediate underlying causes of crime. And what are those underlying causes of crime? Clearly it would be unemployment, poverty, illiteracy, youth delinquency, inequality in the society, and many other similar social factors. But unfortunately, this is not a mandate for the NPA to resolve and eliminate social causes of crime. But it's important that we look at those as well and make concrete and cogent recommendations to those who are directly mandated to deal with those, to help in the reduction of those. So that we are not only focused on removing criminals, as many as possible, from society. So, look, my second point would really relate to the point which Advocate Abram raised in relation to the mandate of the vision of NPA. And the power that goes with it, which he refers to powers of review. It would seem that NPA, unlike many countries here in South Africa, seem not to have or to be obliged to prosecute once a case has been made. Let me rephrase myself. The NPA in our country, unlike in many countries, seem not to have an obligation to prosecute once a case has been made. And this is precisely because of power of review that any NPA has.
Matthias, is it not true that you can institute prosecutions and the investigating officer asks for a postponement for further investigation? Can you blame the NPA if such a situation arises?
No, that is not my point, Honourable.
What is the point?
My point is, in view of the power of review, which the NPA seem not to have to be obliged to prosecute once a case has been made. The next point I'm making,
but if the matter is on review, is before the courts, how do you proceed if the courts are still seized with the matter? Because I want to make sure that we don't make sweeping statements which may create a wrong impression about how the NPA works.
At least I've been in an interrogation room in Bloemfontein, Fontaine building in St. Andrew Street.
I hope
you're not going to put me again.
Maybe I should say, do you understand the question?
If I may just, I think I understand the question. He's talking about the review by the NPP, as opposed to the review by the courts.
Yes.
So if we are to be a little bit patient, or else I have a sense that I'm being interrogated.
You know the chair also is entitled to understand the proceedings. So if I don't understand, I need to intervene to be helped. So I have been helped, and thank you, Honorable Matthias.
Don't make me relive the experience of the past. Of Fontaine Building when I was interrogated by the special branch. I'm saying, Honorable Chair, NPA has enormous discretionary powers to decide whether or not to prosecute or not. And often these powers seem to be abused. And I would want to put perhaps before Advocate Abrams and the delegation the following questions. Whether these discretionary powers are ethically and competently used, or if these powers are open to arbitrary abuse, and if these models that South Africa uses is not open to abuse, is it designed to serve justice? And if yes, how? And if these discretionary powers that the NPA has are not open to abuse, are they not leading to selective prosecution, as it is the public perception today? And if the answer to this question is in the affirmation, would they be eager to open the case in relation to Dadani, the case which has been closed and thrown away, and would they be eager to have interest in that case in a similar vigor that the NPA and the judiciary shown in the case of Oscar Pistorius? And these are two different cases altogether. But the Dadani case was dismissed on the basis of lack of evidence. Yet, there were video clips, and footages, and all of that to the contrast. Would want to know if they're eager to open that case once more.
With respect, with respect, should this committee be the one that identifies cases which must be reopened and those who must be closed, shouldn't you or others in your private capacity follow the matter up with the NPA?
Okay, fine.
Just putting your question.
We'll follow it up with the NPA. But the essence of these questions is to get to the following point, Honorable Chair. That the primary and foremost and urgent task for the current Director of National Prosecution, Advocate Abram, the need to urgently take steps to strengthen and to enhance public trust in the NPA. And should he get it right, surely the public confidence in the NPA would have been restored. And he has it against himself and the generation after him to restore the public trust in the NPA, and got confident that he would be capable of doing that, not regardless of political interference that always hovers above the NPA. Honorable Chair, let me quickly deal with some aspects of the report here in relation to case flow management. That we have been told that there are certain success cases or success in relation to prosecution. And we're told that conviction rate has been at certain percentages at various court levels. But we are not being given enough and adequate information in relation to the baseline information.
this conviction rate. I guess that in absence of the baseline information of conviction rate in respect of case flow management, it will be difficult for us to do an oversight over the NPA and broadly over justice system. And this will always point to us not able to measure performance of the NPA in respect of its key performance indicators, and this will always lead into wrong and assessment which is not based on truthful reporting. The case flow management must also tell us the strategy in place to deal with the reduction of backlogs. We seem not to be having any indication if there are backlogs in terms of conviction rate, in terms of cash flow management strategy. What is the level of case backlog that NPA is facing today? Because in dealing with the court case backlog, it will then be able to say these statistics and the figures that are provided here are based on concrete, tangible work on the ground in respect of reducing the level of backlog, and perhaps that we need to get some sense of a strategy in place if the NPA has to reduce backlogs. Awaiting trial prisoners. This talks to one of the two strategies that earlier on I spoke about, which predominantly seem to be the strategy of criminal justice, criminal system world over. That people are criminals or potential criminals or suspects are taken away and dumped at correctional services. And some of them remain in these centers for months, if not years, waiting trial. Is there any strategy which they can develop and share with the police and correctional services to relieve our correctional centers of trial-awaiting suspects and prisoners by providing alternative means of keeping or dealing with suspects who ordinarily would be, if not kept in police or in holding cells or in correctional centers, would be creating space for those who have already been convicted? There seems to be no strategy in place to deal with awaiting trial suspects and prisoners. And if they do have, can they share that with us? Thank you, Chair.
We said yesterday, recommended that we need a joint meeting of all the departments so that we can deal with these questions of strategy and things like that on the integrated justice system. So I guess that in preparation for that meeting, you will address that you don't have to create something that is not there in this meeting. Thank you. Over to Advocate.
I haven't spoken, Chairperson.
I'm very sorry.
No. thank you, Chairperson. I won't be long. But just to caution us as a committee to say we need to actually move away from trying to micromanage institutions and government departments, because if we try to do that, it's not really going to be helpful. Instead of being transformed, it's going to really create such huge confusion. And I hope a lot of things that we have said are not going to be taken with as if it's what we are really meaning. Like, you know, this thing of mentioning individual cases as to how far we are with those cases. We believe in your ability. I don't think you've just been appointed in these positions for the sake of it, it's because you qualify to do the job. So what you need to come and present before us is to prove that, because we are an oversight structure, prove that this that you've been given responsibility to do in terms of your mandate is being properly carried out. And of course, where there's concern, we can use other channels of actually getting to individual and specific cases, which I think it will be very fair on both sides. I'm quite worried about, and to welcome the presentation, to say thank you to the presentation, well prepared. But at the same time, I need to say that the worry is the overspending that you have experienced previously, and I'm hoping that with the coming financial year, there wouldn't be any overspending. And even concern is also around the reduction of your budget, which has got implications in terms of your targets. But it will be good for you to actually try and see to what extent you will be in the position to achieve these targets. When Dr. Ramaite was presenting the targets, I had a bit of a problem because, you know, I couldn't have a sense of impact in certain areas, especially when you talk about percentages. For me, maybe numbers makes more sense, because that percentage, you don't have an idea of what numbers we're talking about. You know, if you're going to be doing two cases and you talk about percentage, that you will manage to achieve, and you mean one case, it means 50% thereof will achieve. So I think maybe we should go back to the numbers so that we can be in the position to, you can manage to clearly indicate to us as to whether we are really making impact. And also doing some form of a comparison between now and previous. Because if you talk about what you intend doing, but it doesn't really go back, and when you try to go back yourself, you see a percentage, it actually makes you to feel like a kind of lost. Another area that I'm actually interested in is the whole issue of efficiency enhancement committee, as to how it operates and whether it will actually have any form of impact in relation to the issue that is banning that of remand detainees. Because it's something that we keep on hammering on, taking into consideration the high population of remand detainees that we've got in our correctional services. If you can indicate when it comes to remand detainees, what kind of challenges you are experiencing as a cluster, and how yourselves are actually responding to what has got to do with you, because sometimes when you have other departments coming in and then, for example, correctional services sitting here, they will actually tell you that sometimes it's because of the fact that maybe there is slow prosecution and things like that. And of course, I know you will actually talk about investigations and things, but at the end of the day, what we will like seeing as a country is us managing to deal with the high population of remand detainees, because it becomes costly for the country to have people just sitting in correctional services. We don't know whether they, whatever is alleged they have done is something that they are going to be convicted on. And some are there because of the fact that they can't afford little sums of money, 100, 1,000 rands, bail and things like that. And Honorable Swart emphasized alternative dispute mechanism, yes. Which I think is things that we need to really consciously start going back to. For me, if you come back in future and just start reporting on this, and we see the figures when correctional services is coming here, really dropping, I would actually say this is one big impact that will actually make us happy. And previously, we have indicated, I can see that you are now indicating that you are really focusing on the fight on corruption, both in government the scourge of corruption, both in private and government sector, but indicate the numbers so that we have an idea of what you're talking about. And even this whole thing about corruption in government, you keep on hearing about corruption in government, but what we, how we respond to it, you say, but we've got institutions that are supposed to be dealing with corruption. Are these institutions supposed to be telling us that they're failing? They can't deal with this corruption, because it shouldn't just be talk or grand talk that there is corruption in government.
Why shouldn't we wait for those institutions to come here and we tell them that they must tell us whether they're failing or not?
Yes. So at NPA is here. They're part of institutions that are dealing with corruption. So what you need to do is to give us figures in government department. At local government level, these are the number of cases that we've actually managed to successfully prosecute in the provinces. The national government will be happy. And then you go to the private sector. Because you know, the general feeling sometimes is that, you know, it's like corruption that is properly attended to. It's corruption in government departments. When it comes to private sector, it's as if there's leniency. So if you have the numbers and figures, then they have proper justification in terms of the kind of debate that you find in the public.
One will come across as saying that be lenient with us too because we are lenient with the private sector.
No. There shouldn't be any leniency, because what we are saying is that the message that we are sending as a committee is that in South Africa there is no room for corruption. And we want to see corruption being fought vehemently. And why? Because corruption actually impacts directly on the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and inequalities. If we want a true and real democratic system, we need to get rid and eradicate corruption. As long as there is corruption, there will continue to be inequalities. So the message we are sending to NPA today, even other structures, I think they will get the same message, to say that South Africa wants to get rid of corruption, but what is important is for us, when you account to us, to give us figures so that these figures can talk to the stories that you hear, because we want the stories about corruption also to die. If the stories continue, it means the institutions that have been entrusted with responsibility to deal with corruption are not really doing their work. Your conviction of sexual offences at 72%, for me, I want 100%. You know, you've done well, but it must be, we must have harsher sentences for violence against women. I'm sure you realize that over the past weekend, what was just reported was these many rapes of women. Poor women are just standing there, they are looking for transport, and they get raped. Some in front of their children. It's totally unacceptable. We want to see harsher sentences. And I know it's not your responsibility only. You depend on the evidence from SAPS. But the message we are saying,
they can call for harsh sentence, but it's for the courts.
It's for the court to decide, it's for the SAPS to bring enough evidence so that they can be in a position to successfully prosecute. But today we are with them. We can't talk to the courts, we can't talk to SAPS today. Today we're talking to the prosecution. And to the prosecution, the message we are saying is that we want to see harsher sentences for them. Thank you for
I'm sure. Advocate Abrams and your team, you can see how much freedom of speech we have, and we don't want it limited, we enjoy it, but that shouldn't mean that you must answer questions that you were not prepared for, because we don't want speculation as well, and there may also be questions that our homework that you want to take back and then come back to us when you are ready. So don't feel under pressure and respond to what you are in a position to respond to.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson.
I'll try and respond to as many as I possibly can, and those of you can't, I will accept your generosity by deferring that for two responses where it's appropriate to do so. I'd like to start off by the questions posed by Honorable Horn. It's quite correct that Advocate Jiba, who is a Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions, and Mr. Mkhwebi, who is a Special Director of Public Prosecutions, who heads the Specialist Commercial Crime Unit, is on special leave. To this end, I had written a letter to the DA's lawyers in response to a letter from the DA lawyers setting out the circumstances and terms under which they are on special leave. This is correct. They did approach me for special to be placed on special leave. Special leave is it's a voluntary approach taken by them, and I acceded to that request. One of the conditions of their special leave is to the effect.
Let's trust the ability of Advocate Adams to deal with the matter.
Yes, I'll be very quick here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about process, I can say that if Honorable Horn asks questions about a matter that the DA has got interest in, doesn't it actually mean that he's conflicted himself to be asking that question as a member of the committee?
You should have intervened at that stage and raised a point of order. I allowed the question, so Honorable Horn is entitled to an answer, and answer is being given.
It's based on the response, because we didn't have this information that's been provided to us.
No, with respect to your order,
thank you, Honorable Chairperson. So as stipulated in my letter to the DA's lawyers, one of the conditions of the special leave is that should I require them to come into the office for any specific reason as a result of work they've done before that I need clarity on, or to perform any function that I need them to perform as a result of work previously done for clarity on an issue, I can request them to come back. Now, they have not returned to work with the exception of one day when they came into the office, and I haven't requested them to come back to the NPA again. The issue of whether the NPA has considered withholding remuneration from Advocate Jiba and Advocate Mkhwebi, it's a fairly simple response. It's not for the NPA to consider. It's for the president, to consider when the president, should the president consider invoking the provisions of Section 12.6 of the NPA Act. Now, the president has made a decision in this regard, and he's communicated that to the relevant parties and to the public, where he has clearly stipulated that he is not he's not going to invoke the provision of Section 12.6 by suspending Ms. Jiba and Mr. Mkhwebi, nor is he going to hold an inquiry into their fitness to hold office. He will await the court processes to unfold and to finalize and to be concluded. And he's satisfied with the arrangement that they are on special leave. The issue of the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit and whether they have or any of its members have engaged with the Minister of State Security. The proclamation that creates the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit clearly stipulates that the advice on security issues is advice to be given to me as a national director. Of course, they will manage investigations and give direction to the relevant authorities in the investigation of matters, but none of the members of the PCLU have engaged with the Minister of State Security
on the issues raised by Honorable Hall. Advocate Machukwene will respond to your question on the downward trend in performance and the question of targets raised. Dr. Ramahiti will respond to your question on whether the NPA is prepared to relook at its targets on conviction. Similarly, the issues raised around corruption and cybercrime targets, as well as the question of the AFU targets, we have brought in. There was a vacancy of a special director in the asset forfeiture unit. We brought in an acting special director, Advocate Knox Molele, who has been a leader in the asset forfeiture unit for many, many years, vastly experienced, extremely competent. We brought him on board into the asset forfeiture unit a few months ago to strengthen the capacity in the asset forfeiture unit. The results have already become evident. We think that was a good intervention for us to assist and strengthen the capacity within the asset forfeiture unit to deliver on its mandate. Now, there was a question around the number of awaiting trial detainees and statistics around it. We're happy to provide statistics via a written response to that question. But I just want to go a bit further and say, on the issue of remand detainees, the NPA does meet with other stakeholders on a monthly basis to revisit the position of those people that are incarcerated that have paid bail. I specifically have given instructions that in instances where people have appeared in court for their first appearance, that by the next appearance, if bail has been granted, but by their next appearance, if they're still in custody, that the prosecutor and the investigator must be in a position to say whether alternative means cannot be considered to have those persons released from custody, especially if it relates to non-serious offences. In my view, all offences are serious, but there are circumstances such as socioeconomic factors that must be considered when we look at the issue of bail. So that's really a priority for us, and that is reducing the amount of remand detainees. Another project that we're currently working on is giving effect to the provisions of the Section 63, capital A, subsection 4 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which relates to the release or amendment of bail conditions of accused on account of prison conditions. Now, the overcrowding of prisons is a condition, is a serious factor that does come into consideration. We've engaged with the judiciary on this issue, with correctional services. The team that's working on this is in the process of making a submission to me. We are in the process of formulating directives in this regard. Of course, the last clause of the relevant subsection
provide that these directives must be submitted to Parliament before they can take effect. So the moment those have been concluded, and of course we have engaged the Ministry on this issue, we hope that this will then be submitted to Parliament to give effect thereto. I'm very pleased with the progress of this initiative to date, and I have no doubt that once finalized and given effect to, it will have drastic positive consequences for reducing the amount of waiting trial detainees. It is correct, as I stipulated yesterday, that there is the usage of video conferencing for the postponement of certain matters. Of course, it's not been rolled out to all centres, and there are challenges around the implementation thereof. The use of African languages in court proceedings. I support the use of African languages in court proceedings, especially so where all the parties in the proceedings are speaking the same language. This particularly happens in our rural areas where the presiding officer, the prosecutor, the lawyers, the accused, the witnesses, all speak the same language. I would support that. The only challenge is in the event that there is, of course, reviews or appeals, and those records need to be transcribed and interpreted. And I know we discussed this issue yesterday, Honourable Chairperson.
I have had this concern that would have challenges when there are appeals. But it then, if that is the case, it would mean that we're doing things for the convenience of the advocates in the higher courts and the judges. And that then raises the question, shouldn't we make a requirement that no one must be a lawyer in practice in this country unless they've learned other languages? Because we can't do things for the convenience of the elites. Justice must be accessible to the ordinary people.
I agree completely with you that we need to support access to justice to all of our people, rich or poor, remote or urban. We need to be fair to all members of society. So I would support the use of African languages in court proceedings. Dr. Ramayiti will speak on slide 12, the value of the freezing orders. I want to speak very briefly around the issue of illicit flows as raised by Honorable Swart. Firstly, the suspicious transactions that have been referred to during the presentation to the Finance Portfolio Committee, as supported by other portfolio committees present on the day. The NPA has requested that these matters be brought to its attention because they've not been brought to our attention before. So we were unaware of these. I'm very pleased you raised the issue, Honourable Swart, around capacity and the ability of government and law enforcement, and of course the NPA's role in dealing with financial flows and money laundering, because that goes hand in hand, quite frankly. The FIC Act and the Amendment Bill. Now, in the early 2000s, when the FIC Act was promulgated and came into operation, its preamble makes provision for the creation of the Financial Intelligence Center and the creation of a Counter-Money Laundering Advisory Council. The Financial Intelligence Center was created, but the Money Laundering Counter-Money Laundering Advisory Council was never created. The FIC Act, prior to its amendment, as envisaged in the amendment bill, specifically provided for representatives of government, such as the Director General, Treasury, the Governor of the Reserve Bank, the National Director of Public Prosecution, the National Commissioner of Police, the Commissioner of SARS, the Director General of State Security, Director General of Justice, representatives of the banking industry, and representatives as nominated or recommended by the Minister of Finance, constitute this Counter-Money Laundering Advisory Council. It was obligatory in terms of the Act for the Minister to have appointed a chairperson out of the legislative listed individuals to chair that meeting or that committee. The role of that committee was to advise the Minister of Finance on money laundering, terror financing, and issues such as illicit flows. The amendment bill does away with that committee. And one of the recommendations I had made to my team, addressing the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on finance on illicit flows, was that it was a grave error for that committee to have been omitted from the Amendment Act. And serious consideration must be given into revisiting this position, because you cannot merely create ad hoc committees where there's legislative provisions requiring and placing obligations on a committee to deal with issues of money laundering, terror financing, illicit flows, and associated typologies. That being said, we did feel the need to create a structure during August last year, represented by a few other government departments, as a direct result of the almost uncontrollable increase in illicit flows and the modus operandi associated therewith. Cooperation and collaboration amongst all government departments and stakeholders and the private sector, the financial institutions, is absolutely necessary to eliminate or curb the ever-increasing scourge, and I can call it a scourge, of illicit flows. Because billions of rands leave this country on a monthly basis. As Dr. Ramayiti said, in our stretched capacity, we have constituted teams to be able to deal with these matters. So we do have the capacity, but we welcome more funds to procure additional capacity to deal with the issue of illicit money flows.
But,
I'll move on to the next.
Why do we allow offshore banking and then complain that the funds leave the country? What mechanism do we have to distinguish between the funds that flow out legitimately and those that flow out illegitimately?
Honorable Chairperson, there's various modus operandi to bypass the formal banking sector to transfer money out of the country. Now, regrettably, there are examples that I can give you, but it would alert the individuals that are conducting this modus operandi that we are very well aware of. So I regrettably cannot take the committee into confidence, because of
no,
course
no,
we...
No, I accept that. I was just wondering why this is allowed, as many are saying there are other ways.
About the private sector, so you can see something is being done.
And as Honorable Swart is pointing out, the cash flow.
Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. In respect of the question of whether there has been prosecution of individuals that have failed to be whistleblowers or provide information where they're obligated in law to provide the information of corrupt activities or wasteful expenditure, I'm unaware of any such prosecution that has taken place to date.
The person is a whistleblower. Is that not optional? Because if I have seen things, I have the right to decide whether I must whistleblow or not. What do we mean? What is the issue?
Chair, there is an obligation.
In terms of the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act, where you become aware in as a public servant or in the private sector, where you become aware of a corrupt activity in excess of 100,000 rand, there is an obligation on you to report it. And if you don't, there is a criminal sanction for that. So in addition to your Protected Disclosures Act, which is your, and NEMA and the Companies Act that give whistleblower protection, this is also an obligation on people that become aware of corrupt activities, irregular activities, that they should report it. And that this committee passed a number of years ago. So it is in addition, it's to almost encourage whistleblowing, but also to say that if you are aware of a criminal activity, you should be reporting it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether the law is not trying to go too far, because then you have a burden of proof. You must prove that I was aware, and I say I was not aware, then it's again chicken. But anyway, that's what the law says. Let's leave it.
Thank you so much. Of course, this becomes absolutely crucial when we look at reports from the Auditor General. And it was absolutely crucial for the ACTT, the Anti-Corruption Task Team, to, of course, engage with the Auditor General in this regard. And
to be able to establish whether certain matters should be investigated further or not. Honourable Smith, Honourable Swart, I hope your question has been answered. The comment was made that the best years of the asset forfeiture was 2014-2015, specifically looking at that massive value of recovery of 1.5 billion. In reality, more than a billion of that amount was actually not cash that came back to the NPA. That went directly to the victim. And was the value and not the amount as such. So not to take away the good work that had been done by the asset forfeiture at the time, it's respectfully somewhat overstated because it was the value and not an amount as such. Advocate Machakweni will speak on the question of the collapsing of the ADRMs and the verdicts. As well as on the withdrawal of criminal cases. Of course, it's important, you know, for the NBA to be able to manage the core function, its core function, the performance of its core function, to state it more correctly. Specifically around the issue raised around the measurements of convictions. And I agree that this is something that must be taken up with the Office of the Chief Justice. And it does impact on the NPA and the measuring of the NPA's performance. I do believe, as briefed by my team, that that information will still be available to the NPA, even though it's not reflected, in our APP. But we do keep that to measure our own performance and to compare. And you're quite correct when you raise the issue of the decrease in court hours and the finalization of cases aligned to conviction. Honourable Motapo, I think there's some sort of misinformation around the issue of the reduction of Tutazela care centres. We've never reduced the amount of Tutazela care centres, or the number of Tutazela care centres. We've had 55, ideally we'd want 60, and we've approached the Carter Committee to provide us with funds for the additional 5. And in the event the committee does agree thereto, then we'd be able to establish the following 5 to make an amount of 60 over the next 3 years. Now, what specifically happened back in 2014, we wrote to Treasury to request Treasury that the target be 55 and not 60, and Treasury agreed thereto, but it appears that it has erroneously still been left at 60, with not 60, it is in actual fact 55. I'm not sure if you're satisfied with my explanation around that. There's no reduction in the TCC centres at all. There are 55. That's right. But due to the financial position we found ourselves in, the target was reduced to 55.
But as I said before you today, I can assure you that we've reached out to the Kara Committee to ask for money to be able to create the additional five centers over the next 3 years. So there is that commitment from us to develop the additional five. Advocate Machukwene will speak about the difference between the victim empowerment centers and the Tutazela care centers. As the NPA, we are in a position and will be in a position to prosecute matters in contravention of the Hate Crimes Bill when it does come into law. I don't want to elaborate any further on the whole issue to avoid politicizing the NPA as a result of matters that are in the current climate in public. Advocate Machukwene will speak about the gender-based violence training and around the Zabazita project. Honorable Matopo, in terms of the NPA Act, the National Director has original powers to decide whether a matter should be prosecuted or not, and the National Director can himself prosecute the matter in any court in the land. However, it's very, very seldom where a National Director, where I personally would utilize those powers to institute a prosecution in a matter, if that matter had not gone through the process of being considered by the Director of Public Prosecution or the Special Director, and I have not been asked to review that matter in terms of the provisions of Section 22, Subsection 2C of the NPA Act, or is envisaged equally so in Section 179.5 of the Constitution. So you've asked me to take the nation into confidence, and I can easily take the nation into confidence by saying I've not decided on any matter to prosecute. If there is a matter that I've decided to prosecute in, I will own it. I will say so, that I have made a decision to prosecute in a particular matter. I never use those powers. If circumstances do arise where I need to utilize those powers, I will. But I'm satisfied right now, in the given matters, to utilize the powers envisioned in Section 22, Subsection 2C of the NPA Act. And Section 179, 5D of the Constitution. Dr. Ramaiti will speak, but before actually getting to that, in terms of the NPA Act, I have powers over all officials appointed in terms of the NPA Act, contrary to any other law. So the NPA Act will supersede any other law. So everybody derives their powers as delegated by me in terms of the NPA Act. I'm not sure if you wanted to speak before about it, or if I've answered your question on the board. Thank you. Of course, you know, losing personnel, you know, is never a good thing. And when prosecutors in particular embark upon careers in the NPA, the majority of them do so to embark upon lifelong careers. Time and money, regards to training, empowerment, transfer of skills, transformation initiatives come into consideration. All this is utilized to develop the requisite expertise in the institution. So we're never pleased when people resign from the NBA, but we can never stand in people's way. So if people resign from the NBA because they want to embark on a different journey, then we have to wish them well on that journey. But we also lose people as a result of being dismissed, as a result of passing on, death. But I'll have Ms. Hanneke van Zyl speak a bit more about the circumstance under which we lose personnel. Honorable Mahile, I think he's left us, but let me respond to his question. I've dealt with the issue around the overcrowding of prisons as part of this one question. But he's also asked a question around caseflow management. The issue of caseflow management is the responsibility of the judiciary. And not that of the National Prosecuting Authority. Although we are dominus litis in respect of the matters we place before court, the judicial officers are responsible for case flow management. So in other words, when a matter is placed in the court law for the very first time, it's the National Prosecuting Authority's responsibility to firstly ensure that there's a case to be answered, there's an interest of justice to proceed with that prosecution, and ultimately give guidance to the finalization of that investigation, where the investigation has not been concluded as yet, and then for the presiding officer to ensure that no time is wasted in bringing that matter to finality. And of course, to decide on how many trials are set down per day, how many matters are placed on the court trial for that particular day. So ultimately, the judicial officers are responsible for case flow management and the sitting of the court hours. That responsibility did lie with the NPA in years gone by. And I've always stated that maybe it's time that we revisit this position, and a case flow management is the responsibility of the NPA and not with that of the judiciary. Honorable Mahila had also asked a question around how offenders are held accountable. Of course, we, the police, investigate fearlessly and have people arrested, and we prosecute without fear, favor, or prejudice. And where circumstances require, we ask courts to impose the most stringent or harshest sentences. But where there's leniency that's required, we equally request the court to be lenient. So offenders, we do ensure that offenders of crime are held accountable.
Yes, we also don't want arbitrary, fixed heavy sentences. There must be penal policy which the judge
Again, with the issue of corruption, particular corruption in the private sector, of course, we're largely dependent, you know, on the public sector, on the police to investigate these matters and to bring that to our attention for us to be able to prosecute them. We're also dependent on the community to assist us in this regard. Honourable Mahila also raised the issue of private prosecution, and he specifically asked, whether there's a need to be excited or need to be concerned. There's no need to be concerned or need to be excited. The Criminal Procedure Act provides specifically for in the event where a director of public prosecutions declines to prosecute in a matter, where a person has substantial and peculiar interest in a matter, and there's other criteria that said that the director of public prosecution must issue a certificate nolle prosequi upon application thereof. But there are specific requirements that the person must be individually affected and must have suffered harm. If we look at the history of applications submitted to directors of public prosecution over the last, well, since the inception of the NPA Act, and we have those statistics available, there are merely a handful in each province, and some provinces have not even received applications for private prosecution. How many have they been successful? There's been one successful prosecution. Where private prosecution has been sought in the history of our country. And that is a murder matter here in the Western Cape. If you look at the typology of crimes, some are fraud, some are assault, some is intimidation. But our courts have expressly held that entities cannot apply for certificates to institute private prosecution. It must be individual. Our Supreme Court of Appeal has clearly also set out the factors in this regard. In December last year, the Constitutional Court was called upon to consider this very issue. This is in respect of the animal cruelty case, where the Constitutional Court didn't feel the need to decide on this matter.
Advocate, thank you for detailed responses. I guess your colleague still has to touch on other things, and it's almost 1 o'clock. Maybe we should just request them to touch on the critical things as we agreed. Other responses can come in writing.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Maybe just two or three things. The rest have already been dealt with. I think the main one relates to the targets that we have set, and a concern that these targets
are somewhat lower than the targets that we had set and achieved over the previous years. But the main one where we are perhaps constrained to concede that we may have to relook at that is Honorable Horn, in connection with cybercrime targets. I have noted that we may have lowered them quite significantly, but that was based on our estimates and our estimated performance. But we make a commitment that we will go back and engage with the unit that's responsible for this target. That is the Specialized Commercial Crimes Unit. I've asked the lady there to note it, and then we will definitely have a look at it again. Now, just to try and clarify on the targets, and I think the important point to note is the optimal performance that we think we have reached over the period, and coupled with the constraints in respect of capacity, we don't think that we will be able to reach the targets that we've been able to reach previously, except. And we are prepared to take a bet and say, well, look, if we do find additional funding, then we are definitely prepared to set down fresh targets. I, for one, have actually been pushing our colleagues to continue setting out fresh targets, despite the fact that we have capacity constraints, financial constraints in particular. But they raised a point that resonated with me, namely that they are there down on the ground. And the people that they currently have are already burning out. And we can see this from reports that we get from our employee wellness being. So I can tell you that we can set fresh targets, but we're just going to continue burning down our people. So it's in that context that we must be understood. But that does not mean that we're not going to strive to actually work towards achieving the targets that we've been able to achieve despite the constraints in respect of capacity. The other issue that was raised was the...
Excuse me, Honorable Mbongo, do you have any issue? Oh, okay. Proceed.
The other issue where we still have a serious trouble and concern, and I think Honorable Mutabo, is in respect of the over expenditure of the OWP. We have no choice, we have no option. This is mainly because of a high operational cost. Because we've got witnesses who are in protective custody, and then we have to have a look at them on a day-to-day basis. We have set aside a budget of 49 million rands, but we have an expenditure of 64 million rands. So you can see already that we start with knowing very well that we're going to overspend. The witnesses that we have on the program are not ours, and then we also have to consider the day-to-day running of the safe houses where they stay. Again, you must remember that the budget that we have been increased is about 4.94% over the last 4 years. But the leases for accommodation have increased by plus or minus 10%, which is way below the 4.94 that we have. And then there's other high expenditures such as the use of vehicles, the S&Ts that we have to pay for the protector. So, I don't know if you know the story. For many years, the Office for Witness Protection was with the Department of Justice, and throughout the years, when I have been placed in charge of it, I have said to DOJ, I'll be happy to return it back to DOJ. But it's our burden. We cannot, because these are, at the end of the day, our witnesses. They are witnesses in our case. So it's in that context that you have to understand the over-expenditure.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, NDC. I think I'll touch a few of the questions. One, I think the NCBP has touched on the issue of the awaiting trial detainees and how the DPPs throughout the country are employing certain means to alleviate the problem of overcrowding in prison. We have appeared before this committee as the different sectors and indicated what we are doing in order to be able to alleviate the awaiting trial detainees problem. The second issue is the video conferencing. 27 centers are actually dealing with the video conferencing postponements. And we are watching this space very carefully because we are looking at whether or not we shouldn't be approaching this committee in the near future once all the challenges that the NDP has indicated are happening in this area are resolved, to look at whether or not we can't extend the legislation to cover issues of bail through video conferencing, because it helps to minimize the escapes. That is a benefit that we have found to exist. Changes in the reporting of the ADRMs and verdicts, as we've indicated, this information is available, and when called upon, we can give this information very specifically around the ADRMs and verdicts. In terms of the withdrawals, we are monitoring the withdrawals, even though we are not reporting regularly on it, but we're monitoring it, and we have set targets. That is 7% in the district courts, 3% in the regional courts, and 1% in the high courts. That they should not exceed those percentages in terms of withdrawal of the matters. In terms of the average court hours, even though we are not reporting, we are actually monitoring this, and I can tell you that the average court hours set by the courts are 3 hours 12 minutes, but specifically the High Court sits an average of 2 hours 55 minutes. The Regional Court sits 3 hours and 25 minutes, and the District Courts are sitting 4 hours and 30 minutes, and this is being monitored on a continuous basis. In terms of the reduction of the distance, I think the NDPP has quite answered that question, that we have not reduced the distances, but we have stopped growing the distances because of the lack of resources. And he is really looking into the CARA account to see whether this can be assisted. The Nabesta program. This was a very, very successful program, and it did, in fact, enhance the capacity of the traditional leaders in terms of handling issues of domestic violence and even sexual offences. This was actually because we had we did a study to find out that many of the women in rural areas preferred not to go to the formal kind of system of justice, and actually went to the traditional leaders in order to be able to have redress of issues, because they perceived that the justice there is visible to them, and people know what has happened to the person who has wronged them. So that is why we then felt that it is important for them to understand the exigencies of domestic violence. It was still continuing with that, and we're doing the embezzles now to make sure that, you know, the legacy doesn't die, and we make sure that the chiefs themselves and the traditional leaders are the ones that are actually training other traditional leaders to be able to deal with these issues. The difference between the Tutuzela care centers and the victim empowerment rooms in police stations, those victim empowerment rooms are really to provide a good space for the statement taking of the police. So there are no real services that are given to the victims there, except for some acute management of the trauma that a crying victim can be found. With lay counselors, they then get contained. So they are really containment rooms rather than rooms where services are provided. So that's the major difference between the two.
Bongo says he's satisfied with the answer.
I think I'm done.
Yes, I answered. I am satisfied. But I was worried because they kept on saying Kara, and there's no conflict of interest between the Okara.
Talking about taking the money from Kara somewhere.
Okay, I still
Honorable Chairperson, thank you. I think my team have concluded in responding to all the questions as best as we possibly can. We would just like to thank this committee once more, for the leadership and the guidance it's given to us to make South Africa a safer place for all. We've taken note of some of the critical issues the committee has raised, and we will certainly reflect on these and report back thereon. Thank you.
I think you should understand
that you are dealing with politicians, and they will always raise issues which actually belong to the political arena. I hope you understand that, but as far as we are concerned, you have discussed yourself very well, and please keep up the good work. We're very happy and satisfied with the standard of the work that you are doing. Keep it up. Honorable members, they are concerned sometimes that we postpone meetings. The policy of Parliament is that when we change meetings that are scheduled, we must get permission. But also, we don't want to get people to fly from Johannesburg or Pretoria to come here at great expense, and they arrive here and find that there's no meeting because members are not available. So can we agree? I've already had indications by some saying Friday they won't be here, but we had said we'll bring forward the meeting of Friday. But the judge, President Mlambo, will not be available earlier than that. So are you all available on Friday? I wonder who would happen.
I may not be available, but I'm still sorting out the issue.
No, but we need certainty because I can't...
But I may not be available, Chair.
Who else is not available?
Honorable Maila.
Who else?
Encourage the opposition.
I can't work on encouragement. I want commitment. Because I can't get the judge president to travel from Johannesburg visitors for to come here, and then we're not here. So I'm marking all of you present. So if you are not available on Friday, then I think the powers and privileges provide for discipline. So but those circumstances must be disclosed now. Honorable Mayor,
can we not be made part of the new discipline in the ANC caucus?
Okay, the meeting...
Person, you must also check with the opposition, because DA has got two members.
No, I know Honorable Hon is always here. So the meeting on Friday is confirmed, is going on, subject, Honorable Mutapo has other things to sort out, but we'll still correct. Yeah. Okay, fine. Thank you very much.